title.
It's a
yeah.
brilliant title.
Right. So the title, which was coerced out of me, was folding, wrinkling, and coiling of fluids. And in fact, some of you probably saw it this morning when you had breakfast, if you had maple syrup or honey on toast. And in fact, the whole talk is about that. So first of all, I've got to apologize because I'm not sure this is really bang in the center of all the activity associated with pattern formation, because I'm going to tell you about things which occur with extremely simple fluids, with extremely simple boundary conditions, and everything is determined by geometry. And it's geometry of very, very simple things, lines and surfaces moving around in three-dimensional space. So this is work that's actually occupied me for a fair bit, so I'm going to actually go through this historically and then tell you where we are right now. And it was all motivated in some sense or the other by a very beautiful paper written by this man on the left, who some of you might recognize as G.I. Taylor. And he wrote this paper in 1969 when he was 83 years old. And the title of the paper is Instability of Jets, Threats, and Sheets of Viscous Fluid. And I'm going to essentially parse that title and try and understand some of the phenomena that he actually motivated, primarily experimentally. He didn't give any theoretical explanations except to actually suggest possible avenues. And the primary example that he started with is this example of what happens when you pour honey on toast or maple syrup on toast. If I actually pour maple syrup or honey on toast from a relatively low height, then the maple syrup or honey just falls and there is an axisymmetric flow. So there's nothing very extraordinary about what happens. But I start increasing the height from which I pour it, and I don't do anything to where I'm pouring it from, and spontaneously at some critical height, the honey starts to coil, if it's a circular cross-section, or if the honey was actually being poured out of a can so that the honey actually had a rectangular cross-section, it would start to fold. Okay, so I want to show that to you. I would have liked to do the experiment, but I'm afraid I'll destroy this once and for all. So let me see if I can actually show that. And in order to do that, I think I have to press the blank button somewhere over here. Okay. So what I wanted to, let's go back, if I can. And wait, there you go. On the left side, you see a coiling of, actually this is not honey, it's golden syrup. It's more or less the same thing. It's a concentrated sugar solution poured, sorry about this, I don't know how to actually get the movie to run on its own.
Get your mouse going.
I can't see the mouse, this is the problem.
If you wiggle it enough,
and I did. Okay, there you go. All right, so this is the phenomena that I would like to actually try and describe. If I have if I have a circular cross-section, then the honey coils. If I have a cross-section which is more or less rectangular, the honey starts to fold back and forth. And I'm interested in understanding not just the onset. In fact, I'm interested in actually understanding what happens far from onset. What can I say about the rate at which it rotates? What can I say about the radius of the filament in the same case over here? What is the wavelength? What is the amplitude as a function of various parameters in the problem? Okay.
In the southern hemisphere, it goes in one direction.
I'll let you answer that yourself. Okay, so that's one phenomena. There are a class of phenomena like this, which in fact now I'm going to show you movies of. Two extremes. Again, can people? Okay. That's, if you just hit blank. Thank you. Extreme examples of this are, this actually happens even with water. Okay, it doesn't always happen with water. This is actually a mixture of water and glycerol. But now it's subject to an electric field. And what the electric field does, an electric field in the y direction, the electric field essentially stabilizes it against the Rayleigh instability. Okay? So essentially, as soon as it's stable against Rayleigh instability, what happens is that this jet comes out, but instead of being unstable by pinch off, it first becomes unstable by essentially this buckling kind of an instability, and then eventually it starts to break. And that happens on the scale of a few microns. And people actually use this nowadays to try and construct polymeric fibers of very, very small diameters. They essentially eject liquid out at very, very high velocities, stabilize it using an electric field so it doesn't break up, and then use that electric field to stretch it out to get extremely small diameters. So that's on the scale of a few microns. On the scale of meters and on a time scale which takes millions of years, here is a picture which I took from a geology textbook of what happens when you have rocks which presumably start to behave, and I'm not going to actually talk about this in any detail, but presumably start to behave more or less like a liquid on time scales which are huge. So they start to actually fold in response to external forces. Of course, we weren't there to observe this, so we don't really know. And as I said, I want to just stop with just that description of what happens on these scales. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So tar would be a very good example of a viscous fluid on the time scales that I'm talking about. Okay. So as I said, I want to tell you first about observations, and I want to actually make very, very simple theories, and I want to ask, what do we actually learn from this whole thing? So I want to go back now and show you a couple more movies which I've actually illustrated on the geometry which I've got on the blackboard. I'll just switch it off, it's easiest. Okay, the next example that I want to show is an example where instead of folding and coiling, which is associated with a one-dimensional problem, so one-dimensional in the sense that I have a one-dimensional object moving in three dimensions or a one-dimensional object moving in two dimensions, I want to switch now to a two-dimensional object, a two-dimensional sheet, which is somehow mechanically perturbed. And there are two ways in which I'm going to actually perturb it, two different experiments that I want to show you qualitatively. One is where I have a thin sheet of extremely viscous liquid, silicon oil, which has a viscosity about a million times that of water, sitting on water, so it's slightly less dense, and then subject to shear. Okay, so this is an axisymmetric geometry. It's a couette type of a problem, but it's a couette problem associated with a thin geometry. And the thin geometry is allowed to actually change, unlike in the usual couette problem. And the usual couette problem, you know, in fact, it's actually linearly stable for all Reynolds numbers. The amusing thing is over here, the couette problem is actually unstable because you allow the geometry to evolve. Okay? So what I want to show you is what would happen in that situation.
How is it shear?
It's sorry, this is not clear at all. So let me push this back. It's sheared. You have a disk over here, and the disk is essentially rotated. Okay, so the boundaries are fixed. This disk is, of course, rotating, so I generate an azimuthal shear, and I generate an azimuthal velocity, which falls off as 1 over r. I don't expect anything to happen if I'd actually confine that layer to be between two glass plates, but now I'm allowing the layer to actually do whatever it wants to. That's the key. I have a free boundary, and I ask what would happen. And what would happen is what is shown over here. So here is this disk. Okay, this is the outer wall. I spin this, and I spin this, in this case, in a counterclockwise direction, and I start to see the formation of a spiral. And I want to show you that this is a liquid, because we started it up, you saw the spiral form. As soon as you stopped it, it took a certain amount of time, but it decayed off. So this is just a simple Newtonian liquid at the shear rates that we're looking at.
But what is the spiral? Is it just
variation of thickness? No, exactly. It's in fact associated with the entire film moving in and out of the plane, and there are no variations in the thickness. That's the point. Just like in the case of the buckling of this liquid column, where the thickness was remaining the same and the sheet itself was moving around, over here it's two-dimensional. Exactly. So that happens when I have a flat sheet. Okay. If instead I had a curved sheet, that's the third example which I want to talk about, then I see something completely different qualitatively. And the third example is associated with what would happen if I had a bubble of air which I inject into a viscous liquid. So somewhere here I inject a bubble of air into silicon oil again. The bubble of air rises to the top. It forms a hemispherical dome. This hemispherical dome then bursts. You wait for long enough and it bursts, typically near the North Pole. And what you see just after it's burst, there are two views of this. I'll have to do this again. This is a real bothersome thing that I can't see the mouse at all. I don't want to show this to you. Okay, so on the left side is real-time image. There's the hole. The bubble is a couple of centimeters wide. And why isn't this playing? There you go. Okay. Let me play it again. And it seems like the only way to play it. Okay. and you play it again. So I want you to observe, this is the bubble, there's the hole that's formed, the bubble is going to deflate over here, and you see, you start to see a very, very beautiful pattern of wrinkles.
What's the fluid?
Silicon oil. Okay, it's the same fluid that was used in this experiment.
Did that break with water too?
No.
Why not?
If you wait, I'll become clearer. Okay, and this is a view from the top. This is with high-speed photography at 1,000 frames a second. This is just real time. So, in fact, if you can't see very much over there, you're not meant to see very much. I want you to look at what's happening on the right side. So the hole is over here. At a certain time, you start to see the spectacular formation of ripples, wrinkles, which are more or less radial. And then you wait for long enough, and then they disappear into the ambient fluid. Okay?
So that bubble is, the surface film is well drained? Is it like?
No, it's not well drained. You can actually make it so that it's well drained. The way we do the experiment is, as soon as the bubble comes to the surface, we puncture it so that we don't have very large variations in thickness. But that's a detail which doesn't really matter. Qualitatively, you'll see exactly the same thing, whether or not you have large variations of thickness or not, as I'm going to try and tell you now. Okay, so the difference between this and this is primarily that I started with an initially curved surface compared to the initially flat surface. And that's going to make a big difference, as you will see when I start talking about explaining it. Okay, so that's it. I'll show you at the end one more set of movies, but I think I'm going to go on now. So what is common to all these things? I've already pointed out. What is common to all these is exactly as Taylor's paper's title suggested, you have long, thin, or thin, large objects which are moving around in three dimensions. Either I have a curve, which is moving in two dimensions, so it's folding, or it's coiling. In fact, I should tell you, this is an experiment where this is truly two-dimensional. You actually have a vertical soap film, and inside this vertical soap film, you drop a blob of soap. And the soap falls, and as it falls, it starts to get stretched out. And near the bottom, that filament, in fact, folds back and forth inside the soap film, inside this vertical soap film. So this is a truly two-dimensional problem. This is three-dimensional, except that it's a filament, but it's moving in three dimensions, and it's coiling up. Okay? And I just showed you these two examples. These are sheets originally flat or originally curved. In this case, it ripples, as I showed you in the case of the bubble. In this case, it actually starts to form this spiral-like pattern. So that's the geometry. What is common to all of them? There is no inertia on any of the problems. All happen at zero Reynolds number. They're associated with small aspect ratios. And most interestingly, you have analogs of all these when you think about elastic objects. If I have an elastic rope and I let it fall, it will coil up. If I have an elastic sheet, it will fold back and forth. If I had an elastic shell, it will actually collapse in similar ways. So the question is there an analogy? And can we actually use that analogy to say anything? And the answer is yes, there's an analogy which goes back more than 150 years ago, which all of us learn and I think all of us immediately forget because it leads to a lot of duplication, as I've seen when you follow the literature. And the analogy essentially goes back all the way to when Stokes wrote down the equations for the dynamics of fluids. And then Rayleigh actually exploited this a little bit. The analogy essentially relates static elasticity and creeping flow, assuming that I'm in the limit of small strain so that I can use linear behavior. And I'm still thinking about, for the liquid, a Newtonian problem. So I have a linear relation between stress and strain rate in the absence of inertia. And the analogy mathematically is exact. It says that if I replace the displacement by a velocity, the strain by a strain rate, and for the constitutive equation I have, as I told you, a Hookean relation between the stress and the strain, or for the stress, for the fluid, between the stress and the strain rate, a linear relation. Associated with each of these, I have usually two constants in the isotropic problem. For the solid, you pick, for example, the shear modulus and the Poisson ratio. For the liquid, you usually have just one, the viscosity, because the other one is subsumed into a constraint which says that I have incompressibility. In the case of the solid, that would correspond to saying the Poisson ratio is 1/2. And that's true in the bulk. So all problems over here have analogs over here. And in fact, Rayleigh exploited this an enormous amount. But we're not looking at bulk problems. We're looking at surfaces which are allowed to move around. So we have to look at boundary conditions. And that's where all the difference usually is. Because in the case of a solid, unless I'm close to a critical point, the free surfaces are free of traction. While in the liquid, that's not true. I have, for example, capillary forces. And therefore, I get all these interesting behaviors with free surfaces in liquids that you're familiar with, such as pinch off and so on and so forth. However, one can imagine that if the capillary forces are not very large, then in fact this analogy should go all the way through, even to problems which have free surfaces, in particular the questions associated with what I just showed you, where I have geometry playing a very large role. Okay? Now Taylor's paper actually talked not only about jets, threads and sheets, but he also talked about instabilities, and so I'm going to take this analogy literally and ask, well, what is the simplest analogy in elasticity, and then try and see whether there is an analog of that in hydrodynamics. In fact, clearly there is, and I'm going to tell you exactly how that can be brought about. So the classic analogy, classic instability in elasticity is the buckling of a strut. Basically, if I have an object, which is a long slender beam, and I push it, it will buckle if the strain is large enough. Well, how large? In order to just estimate that, we can do an energy balance and compare the two modes of deformation which characterize the two possible states in which this beam can be. So I apply a load P to a beam which is originally of length L, and I ask, what happens? Does it actually go into this compressive state where I have a uniform compression, or does it go into this bending state? And the way to analyze this, well, the many ways, of course, and one simple way to analyze it is to look at close to the onset. So I have an angle theta which is not drawn to scale over here, which is much, much smaller than 1. And I have a geometric relation which tells me how the strain, the end-to-end displacement is related to the curvature, just by geometry if there was no extension at all. Okay, so I have this relation over here. And then I want to ask, what is the energy associated with compression compared to the energy associated with bending? So I want to characterize somehow the strain. So the strain is delta L over L, and the stress associated with that is the modulus times the strain, and the energy is just the integral of the stress times the strain. Okay? While for bending, instead of having a uniform strain through the thickness, what you have is a strain which varies linearly across the cross-section. It's tensile on the convex side and compressive on the concave side. So the strain, in fact, is proportional to the curvature, but varies linearly from 0 to something positive on one side, and from zero to something negative on the other side. So the stress is in fact linear across the cross section if the strain is linear. And then the energy is just again the stress times the strain integrated over the actual volume, and I get this relation over here. Why? I'm not going to actually go into the details of this. I mean, it's a one-line calculation. And the onset of the instability from an energetic perspective appears when the energies associated with compression are of the same order as the energy associated with bending. And the only result that I would like you to remember, that you know in fact, because I want to make an analogy to the fluid problem, is that this energy is comparable to this energy when delta L over L is of the order of the aspect ratio squared. So it's extremely easy to actually buckle a long thin object, which we all know very well. Okay? As the aspect ratio becomes smaller and smaller, this energy becomes too large compared to this, and so bending is always preferred. So what's the analog of this problem in hydrodynamics? Or is there an analog? So I want to do exactly the same thing in the hydrodynamic problem. I have a thin filament, which I restrict to move in the plane for simplicity, with velocities v in the vertical direction and u in the horizontal direction, and I want to characterize the out-of-plane motion of this filament, in this case out-of-line motion, which is characterized by delta y, and I'm looking at delta y small. Well, small means essentially comparable to the thickness of the filament itself. And again, it's a long, thin sheet. I'm looking at the case where there's no inertia, so Reynolds numbers are very small, and where the viscous forces completely dominate the capillary forces. So there is no question of having a pinch-off or a Rayleigh plateau kind of instability. So capillary number is also very large. What that means then is that the boundary conditions are exactly the same as that for the solid. Okay? The stress has got there's no shear stress and there's no normal traction on the free surface. And then there is a kinematic condition. I should point out that this was actually first looked at from a less formal point of view in geology by Bio, and then more formally by Buckmaster. And what I want to tell you is essentially a very simplified form of their analysis. Again, I want to compare the two modes. But now this is a liquid, so instead of doing it in terms of energies, which makes no sense, I'm going to actually talk about it in terms of forces or torques. Again, I want to compare now this mode of motion, where I compress it, and so I can have essentially a uniform thickening or possibly some complicated varicose mode, versus this sinuous mode, where the thickness remains constant and the sheet is allowed to move in and out of the plane. Okay? I want to point out now, the big, big difference is purely geometric between these two. If I have a situation where the sheet is essentially pushed and it thickens, that means the velocities in the axial direction are much, much larger than the velocities in the vertical direction. And that just appears out of continuity. Okay? But now suppose I think of the other limit when it's bending. So I have a filament which is 1,000,000 miles long and 1 millimeter thick and very, very viscous. It's made of pitch. And I push the ends together. What's going to happen? It's not going to thicken at all. What's going to happen? It's going to come out of the plane. And so the vertical velocities are actually going to be much larger than the horizontal velocity. So the scaling in this limit is exactly the opposite of this. And that's the essence of the whole picture. In the varicose mode, the velocity in the direction of the long length is much larger than in the direction of the short length, while in the sinuous mode, it's exactly the opposite. So how do you actually get to that? Well, in order to get to that, you can ask, how do you actually look at the forces and the torques associated with these two motions? So just like in the previous problem, but now replacing strains by strain rates, I have dl by l is the strain, and so dl by l by dt is the strain rate for this liquid, Newtonian liquid. The stress, of course, is just that multiplied by the viscosity integrated to the cross-section, and I have an expression for that over there. In the case of the liquid now being bent, I again have strains on one side which are positive and on the other side negative, unlike over here where they're constant through the cross-section. And so the strain rates are also going to actually reflect that. The strain rates are going to be positive on one side and negative on the other side. And the strain rates are going to look like essentially the derivative, time derivative of the strain. And I'm going to tell you something which you can formalize if you do the asymptotics. In this limit where I'm thinking about bending deformations, the thickness is not going to change. So the entire vertical, the vertical velocity slaves the entire filament, which means that the only contribution that I get to strain rate is associated with changes in the radius of curvature. No thickness variations compared to this problem where everything is associated with thickness variations. If I integrate the stress across the cross-section, it vanishes because it's positive on one side and negative on the other side. So what I really have to do in order to compare these two is to compare torques. And I want to compare the torques associated with motions of the order of the thickness. And when you do that, you indeed get what you would have intuitively guessed, namely that the velocity in the vertical direction is much, much larger than the velocity in the horizontal direction by a factor 1 over delta, 1 over the aspect ratio. Or rewriting this in terms of time scales, I will get an additional factor of the aspect ratio when I just replace the velocities by a length divided by a time. Now the length in the vertical direction is of course smaller than the length in the horizontal direction by another factor of aspect ratio. So equivalently I can restate this by saying that the time for bending is small compared to the time for thickening. And that's it. Just like in the case of the elastic solid, if I actually compress the ends a small amount, if it's thin enough it will buckle. The same for a liquid, if I do it fast enough it will buckle. If I do the problem, if I have this 1,000,000 mile long filament and I push the ends together extremely slowly, there's plenty of time for it to thicken. But if I do it relatively fast, then this separation of geometric scales automatically gives you separation of time scales for free. And you don't need any elasticity, viscoelasticity, any of that. And these are just the simplest problems, I think, in hydrodynamics because they have no contribution from the boundary condition. The only contribution for all the complexity comes from geometry.
But
yes.
I guess from the boundary conditions up in the middle, you're taking sort of a column of fluid and compressing it at a constant rate. Is that right?
No. These boundary conditions, this is just saying that the lateral surfaces of the two of the fluid are free of stress. And this is saying that the top surface and the bottom surface are material. It just simply says that the velocity of the top and bottom surfaces are equal to the velocity of the liquid as I approach the top and bottom. Yeah, that depends. I can have an imposed velocity, I could have an imposed force. I haven't specified that yet. I'll come to that in the context of specific problems. But
now, is there an actual bifurcation point?
No.
Smooth?
It just is a question of the time scale on which you're actually doing. The bifurcation is not so much, there's a maximally growing mode, but all the modes will actually grow if I do it fast enough.
But if you do it a little bit more slowly, nothing happens.
Okay.
The function of rate Is there a sharp transition?
If I include capillarity, which I have not, then there is a transition. There is a clear transition, because then what I can do is I can compare the time scale of the filament which is trying to contract on its own, because it eventually wants to become a drop, compared to the time scale of the forcing. So then I would have a transition.
The absence of surface tension?
No. There is no transition. Or if I just push it, I have to ask myself how I'm pushing it. If I apply a delta force, then in fact it will always buckle and there will be a critical...
Push it really nice and slowly, you know?
Yeah.
Something is going to happen.
That's right. That's right. That's right. So if I put... Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Back to another thing that you presented. If you take this flow and you insert at some point some narrow, localized point,
yeah,
it's narrow, how it will affect? Will it reduce instability and slow flow?
So yes. It depends on what the aspect ratio of that neck is. In other words, it depends on what... how narrow it is compared to the length over which it's actually occurring. Because when I say I'm narrowing it down, I have to specify two parameters. I have to specify essentially a shape. So it depends. Yeah?
I'm confused about something. The mapping to elasticity is exact.
It's exact.
But there's certainly a bifurcation in the elasticity problem.
That's right.
Why isn't there one here?
Because you have time in the problem. I'm not saying that I have one mode versus the other. So it's a question of really specifying, asking what I specify. Do I specify forces? Do I specify displacements? That's why. I'll show you explicitly by calculating, if you wait for a minute, why you don't have a bifurcation. You just simply have a fastest growing mode which corresponds to the elastic, to the problem in elasticity where you choose a wavelength. If you just hold on for a minute, you'll see that. Explicitly, I'll actually show you a problem where this occurs. Okay. Right now, this is a bit abstract because I'm just talking about the analogies without specifying specific boundary conditions or an initial value problem. But just if you wait a bit. Okay. So I want to now talk about specific problems, the problems which I showed you. Okay. I want to start by talking about folding, and then I'll move to wrinkling. Because it's easier to actually understand some of these things in the context of folding. So this is again a picture from a geology textbook, which may or may not be relevant. If you look at the geology textbooks, they claim that it is relevant. I don't know. Nobody really knows, because we don't understand the rheology of rocks. But we do understand the rheology of Newtonian fluids, and this is the experiment that I just showed you a little while ago for the Newtonian fluid inside a soap film. Well, so soap is non-Newtonian, and I'll come back to that as well. This is for the Newtonian problem, where I have a sheet of glycerin, which is just falling onto a flat plate, two views of the same thing. It thins in one direction, of course, because of the effect of surface tension, which is trying to round it up. But before it completely rounds up, it hits the ground, and so it folds back and forth, and this is another view of that. So what are the two time scales in this problem? And here there is a real bifurcation. In this problem, there is a real bifurcation, because now I'm introducing actually a second explicit time scale. In the previous problem, there wasn't an explicit, in this abstract problem, there wasn't an explicit time scale which told you how things relax in the normal direction compared to in the lateral direction, simply because I switched off surface tension. So over here, the two time scales are the time scale associated with the fact that a parcel of fluid has to start at the orifice and it essentially comes down over here, so it takes a certain amount of time. And there is another time scale associated with the amount of time that it takes for the fluid to spread out at the bottom, which is determined by viscosity. The first one is determined by gravity, and the second one is determined by viscosity. And so you can essentially estimate those two. And when you estimate those two, so one depends on, of course, gravity is pulling it, and viscosity is resisting that. In the case of the spreading, it's essentially the size of the blob at the bottom, which is determined by just the radius or the thickness of the sheet, which of course is complicated because it depends on how high I poured it from. But suppose I just say it's a given for now, it's just determined by the thickness, then the ratio of these two time scales, you clearly see, depends on the aspect ratio, as it should, just like I was telling you before, because essentially it tells you how long it takes compared to how much time it takes to spread out. And then I already showed you in the previous transparency, without really talking about mechanisms, but just looking at the equations, that as I expect R over H to become smaller and smaller when I pour it from higher and higher, the ratio of the two time scales becomes smaller and smaller. And so effectively, this axisymmetric solution, or in the plane problem, essentially the equivalent of thereof, loses stability, because it's not possible for the extra fluid to come and spread out rapidly enough, so it loses stability. So you can ask, is it possible to linear stability? And the answer is it's an extremely difficult problem. It has to be done only numerically. And the reason for that is because even though the sheet is essentially a thin object far from the floor, it becomes very thick near the floor. And all the interesting thing that's happening is happening near the floor. So it's a fully three-dimensional or two-dimensional problem near the floor, which means that I have to basically solve the problem numerically, while over here I can get by doing an asymptotic theory. And every decade or so there have been attempts, and all the attempts are approximate because it's really difficult, as I said, to deal with this boundary condition, because the whole thing is just slamming into the floor and spreading out. You can do it numerically, nobody's really done it. So these are all approximate in that they basically replace this hard boundary condition by a softer one. For example, by saying that it falls into a liquid which is stratified, so that the density is actually changing, therefore the resistance is actually changing. And so in that case, you see the instability develops in space rather than on the floor. But these never, even if you do it, you're never going to get an answer to a problem like the one that I've shown you over here. I'm not going to get anything like an amplitude, okay? And the advantage of going far from onset is that, unlike over here, where the problem is nasty in the neighborhood of the boundary, over here, the boundary is here, and it's not nasty at all. All I have to worry about is still this thin geometry, but I have to just account for the geometry changing a fair bit. But that's not so difficult. Okay? So I'm going to claim that, in fact, far from onset, the problem becomes easier. And so I'm going to directly go and look at that from the beginning. Well, how do I look at that? I want to look at the dynamics now of a thin sheet moving in the plane. And there are many ways of doing this. This is one way I choose to present it. You can start with the Stokes equations and you can do an asymptotic reduction. You get essentially the same thing. Instead of doing that, what I'm going to say is, in fact, I have, as I told you before, a sheet of now a thickness which is given and not changing. You can actually see that in the experiments. The thickness of the sheet itself is not changing, although the location of the center line changes a lot. And I want to characterize this sheet in the plane. So in order to characterize that, I have to characterize it by its center line and perhaps an angle with respect to some axis. That's the geometric parameters. And those are the geometric parameters to characterize it. And in terms of the forces, I have a force along the tangent of the normal, or the x and the y, and a torque at any cross-section. Okay? And I can write down, in the absence of inertia, an equation for the balance of forces and an equation for the balance of torques, making no assumptions about the geometry. The geometry is whatever it wants to be. It's nonlinear. If the thickness is not changing, then I can characterize the center line by an arc length, and then I have a simple kinematic characterization which just says dy by dx is tan phi in terms of the angle. Now, these equations are not closed because I didn't even tell you whether it's made of a solid or liquid, because I have two variables for the forces and one for the torque, and then I also have the position, four, but I only have three equations. So I have to close it somehow, and I need to actually say what it's made of. And again, I'm going to go back and use this analogy of Stokes and Rayleigh, which, as I said, can be formalized using asymptotics over here. The axial strain, as I've already told you, varies across the cross-section, positive on one side, negative on the other side. The rate of strain is now, because the thickness is not changing, is just the distance from the center line times the rate of change of the curvature, rather than the curvature itself. And because this varies across the cross-section linearly, if I integrate through the cross-section, I get zero stresses, zero net force, but I do get a finite torque, okay? And that finite torque I can express as dependent linearly on the rate of change of the curvature, and there are some geometric factors and the material parameter. And I want to look at this because I want to remind you of something that you all know very well. The moment now for this liquid film is proportional to the rate of change of the torque multiplied by the fourth power of the thickness and mu, in exactly the same way as you would expect for an elastic beam. For an elastic beam, the torque is in fact just the curvature multiplied by an analog, which is a product of the shear modulus and the fourth power of the geometry. Okay? You remember this presumably in terms of energies, if you like, because the energy for an elastic beam is proportional to the curvature squared, so the torque is proportional to the curvature. Because it's a liquid, it's proportional to the rate of change of the curvature. All right, so that analogy follows right through, and now I have a closed system. It's slightly complicated because the contact line in this case is actually moving back and forth as the sheet is being laid out. So you have to solve the problem numerically. You can do a perturbation theory, but that's not very useful. There is one parameter in the problem. So remember, I'm looking at the whole problem far from onset, so I'm not even worried about the bifurcation because I'm so far away from it. The one parameter in the problem is the ratio of the viscous forces to gravitational forces. And that's small. And it's small because buried in it, it has the aspect ratio as well. Because I'm dropping it from a large height, and I want to look at what's happening near the floor. And the contact line problem can be dealt with if I just say that this contact line is moving, and the way it moves is I specify the conditions over there. The conditions are that it touches down smoothly, so that y, not only is y zero, not only is the vertical displacement zero, but in fact the angle is zero, and the curvature is also zero. All right? Okay, so you do that numerically, and here is kind of result that you actually get. Of course, we've looked at essentially the interaction of the contact of the sheet with the horizontal floor, not of the sheet with the already folded situation at the bottom, because that's very complicated. Okay? So here is a time sequence. It starts out, moves to one side, and interestingly, the fold starts to form, and as it starts to form, of course, because of gravity, part of the sheet starts to sag as I'm pouring more and more of it, and eventually touches down and forms a second contact line, which is different from this contact line over here, where the sheet stopped. And then you can ask what happens next. Well, because I have surface tension acting on the small scale, you would expect that this part of the sheet almost instantaneously sinters with what's at the bottom, so I can ignore this part, and then I just have to look at exactly the same thing happening on the other side. And that's exactly what you see when you plot the contact line as a function of time. Contact line forms, moves in one direction, reaches this extreme value, then a new one is born at a different location, and the same thing happens. So I want to understand this now qualitatively. You can actually solve the problem. Well, that's interesting. Can you actually say anything qualitative? And the interesting qualitative things that you can say are associated with the limit when this parameter, which is the ratio of viscosity to gravity, is very small, which corresponds to pouring it from really, really high, and all the things that are interesting are happening in the neighborhood of the floor. Now, in that case, I have no external scale in the problem anymore, because the external scale in the problem was associated with how high I'm pouring it from. So if I'm looking at it near the bottom, everything should be balanced self-consistently, which means, or is everything, viscosity and gravity. And I want to ask, can I get a length scale out of those using this? And the answer is yes. You can start with the equations, or you can essentially start directly by looking at what's really happening near the floor. So there are two parameters which are unknown. There is a frequency of folding, and there is a length of folding. And the balance is, as I said, between gravity and viscosity. Inertia is not important. So what are the forces? So the forces which are making it sag are due to gravity. And I have to ask, what is the characteristic weight of a part of the filament of order the fold length? Because essentially the whole thing changes from vertical to horizontal over that scale. So it is just rho g times the thickness squared for a filament times Lf. That's the weight. And the torque associated with that weight is just that force multiplied by the torque arm, which is rho gr squared Lf times Lf. That's the sagging torque. And that's balanced by the viscous torque, which would like to prevent it from happening. And remember that I told you that the viscous torque is just like the elastic torque, except that it has this additional time derivative, mu times r to the 4 times the time derivative of the curvature. What is the time derivative of the curvature? Well, the curvature scales is 1 over Lf in this region, and the rate of change is just the frequency of folding times that. So I can use this in this relation. And finally, I have a consistency condition which says that wherever, because it's folding periodically, if I feed it at a constant velocity u, then u must be omega Lf. So out of this relation and this relation, I get two scaling laws, one for the fold length, and the other one for the folding frequency, far from onset, I want to emphasize, which of course is consistent with the numerics because that's built in, and it's also more or less consistent with the experiment. I say more or less because it's about a decade of data. The experiment was done in an odd way. Instead of varying all the parameters, what we did was to actually change the height of the soap film. That changed the thickness at the bottom. And then we measured Lf and omega f, the two variables in the problem. And we see that it actually collapses exactly like you should. I want to emphasize this elastic analogy again. If I express the fold length in terms of the frequency, I can write it in this form. Lf is mu omega f r squared over rho g to the 1/3. And the elastic analog of that problem is what happens to a sheet of elastic material which just folds on itself, such as a carpet. Again, there is no length scale, it's just balanced by, it's the length balanced by gravity and elasticity, and I get a scaling law which is dimensional, which is just almost the same. All I had to do was replace the Young's modulus by mu times omega, okay, as you expect. Yes?
This one, your estimate, you know the additional effect of the contraction itself.
That's right.
So sorry,
I missed that.
Do you include, do you expect to start to see additional mod on top of this large body?
Yes. Yeah, I'll show you an example at the end which we are starting to look at where something like this happens. But yes, you're right. That problem is even more complicated because now I have to ask how the whole thing is contacting something which was formed previously, which is deforming, and so on and so forth. So over here, we've ignored that. Absolutely. Okay. So you can do the same thing for the coiling. I don't think I'm going to go into that. Okay, so you can essentially do the same thing for coiling. The big difference in the problem associated with coiling is that, in fact, if you drop the silicon oil in the form of a filament from about a meter or so, the coiling frequency is of the order of 100 hertz. It can actually go very, very fast. So inertia comes in, but this is not the inertia associated with inertia of the flow, it's inertia of just moving this material. And so the balance is slightly different. It's now the balance between inertia and viscous forces, and you get a different scaling law. And we've done that, and you can check it against the experiment, and it more or less seems to work. So I won't talk about coiling. I'll move to wrinkling because it will actually address a couple of the questions that were raised earlier about onset. Okay? So I want to now move to the problem of wrinkling in that geometry that I showed you, where I have this thin film of very viscous liquid, which is slightly less dense than a very low viscosity liquid, in this case water, and it's sheared in this couette geometry at very low frequency. So again, inertia is completely unimportant. And this problem was also looked at by Taylor using an experiment and a little bit of theory, but I'll tell you what that theory was in a minute because we are going to be in a different limit. So Taylor's experiment has, this is an image from his experiment, and he observed these wrinkles. But if you look at the paper, then you find that, in fact, the wavelength of the wrinkles was much smaller than the thickness of this golden syrup. So this is, in fact, a short wavelength instability. And moreover, when people actually looked at his experimental data later on, Benjamin and Mullen did this about 10 years later, they found that, in fact, the experiment was probably contaminated because when he was playing with golden syrup, he came back after a day or two to redo the experiment, and the golden syrup had formed a thin crystalline layer. So it was just the instability of an elastic solid. It wasn't the instability of a liquid. So we wanted to ask, is there something similar to what I showed you previously, but for a liquid? And because we're looking at long wavelength deformations, we asked the same question. Now, instead of saying that the thickness of the film is large compared to the wavelength, we want to say the thickness is small compared to the wavelength. This is work that was done with my student Jeremy Teichman, and the experiments were done in Gareth McKinley's lab at MIT. Okay, so if I was thinking about the situation, I want to first tell you what the mechanism is for the instability. And the easiest way to think about the mechanism is if I think about this radius being very, very large, so it becomes almost like a plane couette problem. So what's the equivalent in the plane couette problem? So I have now this two-dimensional situation. I have a thin film as far as out of plane, what's happening in the out of plane direction. It's not the usual couette problem where it's infinite. And I shear the two ends. So if I shear the two ends, I ask, what is the deformation? So the shear deformation can be, of course, changed into compression and extension at 45 degrees. And indeed, immediately, you see the mechanism of the instability. Because if I just rotate the shear to 45 degrees, I see there is compression. If there is compression and the film is thin enough, then it can start to buckle. And the question is, on what time scales does this happen? So if I do it rapidly enough, then just like in the elastic problem, I will also have an instability in the viscous problem. So I want to characterize that. And if I look at characterizing that, now I'm going to look at the linear instability. and I'll tell you about what happens far from onset. So if I look at linear instability, it's sheared in this simple geometry. I have out-of-plane displacements, which are characterized now instead of in one-dimensional problem, it's two-dimensional. And so I have the same quote bending stiffness. And unlike in the elastic problem, where you might expect as in elasticity often, a fourth derivative of the displacement. Here you get the fourth derivative, but now of a velocity, because I'm thinking about fluid mechanics, and it's forced by shear. So this expression on the right-hand side looks complicated, but it's just a generalization of the Laplace law to an anisotropic stress. What is vibrating? The whole building, I suppose. There's nothing I can do about it. That's great. All right, so this expression on the right side is the forcing, and let me give you a physical feeling for this. This is essentially the stress in the one direction multiplied by the curvature in the one direction, the stress in the two direction multiplied by the curvature in the two direction, and then this mixed term, which is essentially a generalization of Laplace, okay? For anisotropic stresses, Laplace's law would tell you it's just the stress multiplied by the mean curvature, but over here the stresses are different in different directions. So the forcing is coming from the shear, N12, and if the capillary number is large, then I can do a standard eigenvalue analysis, but now looking at maximally growing modes, so I basically substitute in a mode shape of the form e to the sigma t times f of y is this direction, times periodic in this direction plus complex conjugate. And if I substitute into the equations, I want to point out that the problem becomes exactly like that in elasticity by going back to the previous transparency. Okay? So the last term on the right is the driving. So if I look at e to the sigma t, I get a sigma in front. And if I just pull that sigma over and I divide this, it looks like an elasticity problem, but now I have a rescaled growth. Instead of thinking about just sigma N12 being the driving, it's N12 divided by sigma. So the most unstable mode corresponds to the smallest value of N12, which corresponds in elasticity to when the instability arises. So again, this analogy takes you very far. And in fact, I want to point out that without solving the problem, all you've got to do is go back in the literature to the problem of the elastic sheet, which was solved almost 100 years ago, and then you recover exactly the same problem. As I was telling you, minimizing the shear is exactly equivalent to maximizing the growth rate. So the selected mode shape is determined by the maximal growth rate, which in the elastic case corresponds to the buckling transition. I want to emphasize again that in the absence of gravity and capillarity, there is no threshold. All modes grow, but the mode that you see is the one with the largest growth rate, and that corresponds to the situation where in elasticity you have the smallest loading. Okay? All right, that's exactly what I was telling you over here. So if I replace gamma dot over sigma by just gamma, that has a rate dependence. That would be the elastic case. In the elastic case, the dominant wave number is chosen to be the smallest loading. In the viscous case, that corresponds to the case where I have the largest wave largest growth rate sigma, which would correspond to the smallest point right there. Now you can ask, when do you have a threshold? In fact, in the experiment, you do have a threshold in the wrinkling problem. If I have a rotation below a critical value, then I have no instability. If I have omega larger than a critical value, then I get the instability. Okay. So to see the effect of the threshold, you can look at a one-dimensional problem. In the one-dimensional problem of that, now with surface tension, so the original problem was with shear, but I've simplified this. Now I'm just thinking about buckling of this viscous fluid. Now I will include surface tension, and I will also include gravity. So gravity just comes in the force balance, because I have a force which is proportional to how high it is relative to where it was. Surface tension is going to give you a stabilizing term which is proportional to the curvature, and then there is the destabilizing term from P, because P is positive, compression. And now I can basically calculate from this a little dispersion relation, and indeed I see that there is a threshold for instability. The threshold for instability is associated with the fact that that load has to be larger than the surface tension, because in the absence of surface tension, in the presence of surface tension, the whole thing will just collapse on its own. I have to push it faster than that in order to see this. Okay? So when I include capillarity back in the problem and gravity, I will get a threshold in the situation. But without those, I don't get a threshold. I simply get a maximally growing mode. Okay?
But the gravity doesn't appear.
No, gravity doesn't appear in the threshold, but it will come in the selection. Yes.
Just in the K.
That's right. Exactly. Okay. Okay, so now you've got to, once you understand this selection problem in the one dimensional, you've got to go back and look at this full problem. I won't bore you with the details. You can do it, and when you do it and compare it with experiment, the comparison is pretty good. So how was the comparison done? You look at the number of ripples, and you vary both in the experiment and in the numerical eigenvalue problem that you solve, the aspect ratio, this width, essentially. I want to point out that there is something we don't understand still in the theory, and at the onset, in fact, you have just a simple pitchfork bifurcation. But in the experiment, as soon as you go above onset, and it's very easy to go above onset because the film is very thin, in fact, you see the spiral starts to rotate. And that's not captured at this point, and I don't really know why. That's, no, not at onset. Not at onset. At onset, you just get real eigenvalues, exactly. It's not Hopf. Yeah, so it's just a simple pitchfork bifurcation. That's what it seems like, and I don't know. I don't know the answer right now. Experimentally, that's what it seems like. Okay? Nonlinear saturation, well, how do you expect the whole thing to saturate nonlinearly? In fact, the amplitude cannot grow forever because gravity is going to kick in. So by balancing gravity and the resistance to bending, in fact, you can get an expression for, but we haven't checked this expression for onset.
If you did this experiment of microgravity, you would get the same threshold, but k goes to zero. Is that right?
That's right. No, k is not going to zero because I have a finite system.
Well.
Now, this problem is for the infinite problem. In fact,
sure,
it's the system size.
Yeah.
Yeah, agreed.
So in space with k?
Sorry?
In space, these films, the instability wouldn't saturate, it would just clear?
I don't know. Yeah.
That's
that would be the nonlinear evolution. I don't know. I don't know what would happen to that. Yeah. Okay. So I have 5 minutes, and let me tell you qualitatively about what happens when you change the geometry. Instead of starting with a thin, flat sheet, I start with a curved sheet. And there's a very big qualitative difference, which is, I'll tell you about the problem first. Okay. So, in fact, this is what actually got us into this whole business. this is a couple of years old, and I'll show you the analysis is still only approximate. There's still a lot of work to be done. So this was the rippling instability associated with the whole, with the bubble collapsing. This is work done with Rava Silveira, student, and the experiments were done by, in fact, a postdoc then at MIT, Sarawesh Shayem. So I want to answer a question which was brought up by somebody, I can't remember, about whether or not these things will happen with water. So this is a nice example to look at, because you know that water bubbles, that is water forming the bubble and air inside, will also burst, but the dynamics is completely different. Okay, why is the dynamics completely different? Usually when you think about bursting films, in fact the driving force is surface tension, and what limits the rate at which the bubble bursts is inertia. Okay, because I have to take this mass, which was originally all between this point corresponding to the center of the hole and that point over there, and I have to accelerate it. So in fact, there is an inertial balance between, there is a balance between inertia and capillarity, which gives rise to, for example, the selection for the velocity of this hole. And this is, in fact, again, something that was very beautifully described by J.I. Taylor. But in this situation, where we are thinking about a problem where the bubble is made of a very, very viscous liquid, it's all limited by viscosity. And there's a paper on exactly the same problem, addressing that question, addressing just the dynamics of bursting, by Debrajah, Brochard, and Dejean a few years ago, where they were interested in asking the question, what is the rate limiting step, what is the rate limiting process for the whole dynamics? Okay? And as I said, it's essentially viscous. Now, in both these problems, in the inertial and in the viscous case, there are various instabilities, and I'm not going to go into them. I'm going to talk only about the problem over here, and I want to talk about the instability associated with this sinuous mode. In fact, that's exactly, again, analogous to this bending problem. So what is the mechanism of the instability? It's actually very simple. When the hole opens, and that opens either because I artificially poke it or because of gravitational drainage, then there is an overpressure which starts to equalize. The liquid, the air from the inside moves to the outside, And that equalization then causes the bubble to start to collapse. And you've got to ask which time scale is larger, the time scale for the opening of the hole or the time scale for the collapse of the bubble. If it's a very viscous liquid, then it's not going to be able to move fast enough compared to the time that it takes to fall. And then you have the problem, which is actually the origin of differential geometry. When Gauss flattened the Earth, he basically invented differential geometry, and he wanted to ask exactly this problem. But now we are asking this in a physical context. I have this very viscous shell. It wants to collapse because it has excess area. Then it has to actually do this. We are accommodating that excess area in some possible mechanism. There are various mechanisms. It can thicken. But I've already told you by showing you a bunch of examples that, in fact, on short time scales, it's not going to thicken. So it's going to buckle. But if it buckles, then it can buckle in many different modes. Okay? And without calculating, you can actually see what the possible modes are, and you can come to the conclusion of which mode will be selected. One possible mode, okay, so let me get to that in a bit. So if you can quantify this by looking at the time scale for retraction corresponding to collapse, that retraction time is much larger, and therefore, in fact, the whole thing is dominated by the collapse, by gravity. Okay? And more interestingly, from a calculational point of view, in fact, over the time scale, then, the size of the hole is not changing, which is good, because you can parameterize everything in that problem. All right, so I wanted to ask the question about flattening. How can it flatten? So we already know that that the bending time corresponding to the thickening time is very small. And I put this over here because the title of the original paper by Brochard, Degen, and de Brujas was The Life and Death of a Viscous Bubble. And I'd like to add this addendum, namely that before you die, you wrinkle. Okay. So how does that wrinkling arise? You've got to ask yourself geometrically what are the possible modes. So the big difference between the flat sheet and the curved sheet is that for a curved sheet, as soon as I deform it, I automatically stretch it. While for a flat sheet, if I deform it for small deformations, I don't stretch it. And that's a huge constraint. And this essentially changes everything in the problem. So that's the first thing. The second thing is...
stretching is second order in the flat case.
Exactly, because of Pythagoras. Yeah, because you've not got the broken symmetry. As soon as I have a curved object, I've already broken the symmetry, so I immediately have to stretch it. That's very good and very bad, because that says that if I have a curved object and I'm going to deform it, it's going to try and deform without stretching. And now you can ask, well, what are the different possibilities? So the different possibilities, I think, are easiest if I actually try and make motions with my hands. I have this spherical bubble here. It already has a curvature. And then I can ask, I can either add curvature in this direction, so I get azimuthal wrinkles, or I can get radial wrinkles. Well, first answer to whether or not one of these is chosen is that if the bubble is complete, neither of them is good. They're both very, very bad, because for a closed convex object, in fact, all deformations have to change the metric. They will stretch it. But the bubble has a hole, which is great, because if the bubble has a hole, it becomes softer and softer as the hole becomes larger and larger. And then I have to ask which mode is possible. If it's this mode which is possible, or is it this mode? And the answer is it's this mode, because if I have this mode, it's like a conical deformation which introduces flutes. So it's like a situation where I have something like this, but with many folds. And that's easy because I'm not changing the curvature so much since I'm bending it in this direction. This curvature I'm stuck with. And that's exactly what you see. So even without a calculation, one might expect that the simplest thing that the theory should do is, A, it should predict that there is a finite hole size, because the weight of the bubble is fixed. There is a finite hole size before which the instability shouldn't occur. And B, when it predicts the instability, it should predict that, in fact, the wrinkles are all radial, both of which you see experimentally. Okay, so in order to do that, the calculation is what we did was a very simple-minded calculation. We said forget the complications associated with the sphere. We'll in fact worry about the fact that we do it for a simple conical geometry, because that's sufficient to capture everything. Now the key is that I want to actually have deformations from the base state h plus delta h, but I want to actually force the deformations to be isometric. And so I have a constraint which tells me how the possible mode shapes that I choose, amplitudes are related to each other so that it's isometric. And then I have to minimize, if I'm thinking about the elastic case, the balance, I mean, minimize the energy in the problem, which comes between, which is the sum of bending and gravity. Okay? And when you do that, indeed, you recover exactly these two qualitative features that you want, namely, that you do get a threshold. So this is an expression for the number of ripples, number of wrinkles. You do get a threshold. You need some complicated function, which I've not shown you, to be positive, which is consistent with the fact that either gravity has to be large enough or the hole size has to be large enough for the instability to occur. And then you can also compare the theory with experiment, and when you do that, you don't get a bad job. So when I say experiment, how do you do this? Because I didn't solve the hydrodynamic problem over here. Hydrodynamic problem is fairly complicated. The energy approach for elasticity, of course, is not so bad. So we cheated. Okay, and the way we cheated was to say, look, we know this analogy works. I have all these test cases that I showed you, and I have to ask, what is the actual modulus for the viscous problem? Right now, our guess is that the modulus is essentially going to be a viscosity times some frequency or growth rate, and the characteristic growth rate could be the time that it takes for the instability to evolve. How long will it take for the instability to evolve? That's the time taken for the sheet to fall through its own thickness. So that's a guess. We don't know that for sure. But if you put that number in, which you can calculate, the time scale for the falling of the sheet under its own weight, and you use that to estimate the elastic or the pseudo-elastic modulus associated with the viscous fluid, and you compare with the experiment, you don't do a very bad job. I should tell you the two other curves. One is for the elastic case, which we have not really looked at, and the other case is, in fact, in the original paper, they actually hypothesized the viscoelastic mechanism. You don't need that. So they had a new modulus, and then with that modulus, they were able to get at this whole thing. My point is, you don't need the viscoelastic problem at all. You can actually get this purely from elasticity. So I'm done. There are various extensions of this, which I won't tell you about. But I want to actually sum up by quoting, you know, in elasticity, there is a very famous book by Love. And it seems like that's all you need. And I will say, I hope you'll agree with me that it is really simple. Once you understand the elasticity and you understand the analogy, then it's really a question of turning the crank. Thank you very much.
Questions?
Has anybody proposed to do a microgravity experiment? This is to be at the time for that experiment is short. You can do that in a parabolic flight.
That's right. That's right.
So this is very accessible.
Yeah. No, I
NASA would be delighted to.
Yeah. No. None of this. I should also say none of this work is supported by anybody. This is sort of.
Of course, we should first do some more controlled ground-based experiments.
That's true. Yeah. No, the ground-based experiments. I think we understand the onset. We understand
but
the onset.
You want to resolve the issue of
The rotation.
I mean, as long as it is not resolved.
Experimentally, I don't know. I mean, I know that if you look at the problem, there's no ambiguity. You do have a pitchfork. You have zero imaginary part.
You're not in a position to look for secondary applications.
No, it's not beyond. It's just that this was done when a student finished, just before a student finished his PhD. So it's not beyond at all. It's something I hope will happen. Yeah, no, definitely. No, I mean, as I said, my main point is that these problems are none of them are complicated, and all of them could have been solved 100 years ago.
I have one other question. This rotating scramble type setup is actually used to measure viscosity and even also shear strength of
non-Newtonian
Langmuir blodgett
films. Okay.
Now, do these people, are they in parameter ranges where they avoid any of these instabilities?
I don't know. I mean, with a Langmuir monolayer, if it's in a crystalline, if it's close to being closed packed, then you will have the same instability, but it will be really an elastic instability.
That would mess up the measurement.
That's right.
Yeah.
I don't know the answer. I know when people actually take Langmuir films and they start to compress them, you do see these transitions associated with buckling and then folding on top of the layers. But I think the answer is I don't know.
Any more questions?
So there aren't kind of engineering applications of this that would drive
other
interest?
There are. If I think about polymer spinning, And then I think about polymer blowing. If I think about taking plastics and blowing them or spinning them and so on, in their melt state, so if I'm not very close to situations where the viscoelasticity is important, then this is essentially the theory which should be consistent and should be applied. I think there are lots of applications. I mean, if you think about lubrication theory, which is the other limit where the one velocity was large compared to the other, but in the opposite direction, that has a huge number. All the problems, there are free boundaries associated with two films rather than with one, you know, one free boundary. You have two free boundaries. This is natural because this will always appear. Why haven't people looked at it? I don't know.
I was reacting to your comment that it wasn't supported by anybody. And typically things are supported by...
No, that's because I didn't look. So.
You did spend the time writing the proposal.
That's right.
Any more questions?
If you drop a long rope under its own
weight,
and it coils, and... I'm just trying to think, would this apply directly to that for the frequency
of the... For the elastic
case,
yes, exactly. It's complicated because the thing starts to, you know, go all over the place, but yes, if I'm able to do it in a controlled way, yes. In fact, it should happen with any thin filament which is subject to a deceleration. All these instabilities are so heavily driven by geometry that the physics comes in, but it comes in a very innocuous way. I should not say important. It's there, but it's very strongly geometry driven.
Any more questions? Then let's thank Maha for a very nice talk again.